Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
So as you've no doubt heard between yesterday and today, Ian Bailey, the chief suspect in the murder of the French woman Sophie Toscan du Plantier, died yesterday after falling ill on a street in Bantry in West Cork. Sophie Toscan du Plantier was found murdered outside her holiday home near Skull on the morning of the 23rd of December 1996. Our reporter Brian O'Connell is in Skull this morning and is on the line now. Brian, thanks for joining us this morning. What's the feeling or the sense of the feeling there locally?
Yes, good morning, Claire. It's a quiet yet windy Skull this morning as people here and in the surrounding areas are waking up to the aftermath of last night's storm. But I suppose you could say for the past quarter of a century and more, the local community here has been living with the aftermath of the horrific killing of Sophie Toscan du Plantier, just over 5 miles west of here at her holiday home near Tourmore in December, as you said, 1996. The death of Ian Bailey yesterday, who lived for many years before moving in recent years here in Skull. He maintained a stall at the market here. He sometimes sold books of poetry. I suppose his death is just one more episode for the local community here in what has been an unwelcome and a tragic narrative spanning now generations. Skull is a place like a lot of West Cork where for decades people not born here find a sense of place, a sense of community. It's a very open, welcoming, accepting place. But I think it's fair to say that sense of belonging was in some senses shattered by the events in 1996. And since then, there has been this huge public and media attention on this small community here. So understandably, Claire, several people I approached this morning were quite reluctant to say anything about Ian Bailey on tape. Some people I walked up to with a microphone before I even introduced myself said to me, preempted it and said, if this is about Ian Bailey, we don't want to talk. So you can understand that sense of reluctance. But I did begin by hearing from these two people who gave me their initial reaction to Ian Bailey's death.
I don't know, it's just, no, I'll never know, no, really, will they? Whether he did do it or he didn't.
What did you think of him?
Never spent any time with him.
And locally, how was he regarded? Do you think there was mixed feelings?
Sure, I suppose it is, but to be nice if someone knew the truth of it. But the truth will never be found out now, so I suppose this is a closed chapter for them now, really.
They don't actually talk about it because it's sort of private to the people, as it's kind of some it's sensitive thing. They don't go talking about it, so they're very polite in terms of that. They talk about if we're unsure as to whether he did or didn't, we still actually don't know as to what happened, but we know that that happened.
It brought a lot of attention on the area here, didn't it, for the last 26,
yeah.
27 years.
And I think my mum said, yeah, everyone would know about this place from that happening.
Yeah. Your hope would be for the family to get answers at some stage?
Yeah, I do. If it's possible for them to get answers, you think they'd have got some answers by now. I mean, when things like that happen, people sort of feel more comfortable when they know what's happened, because otherwise if you don't know what's happened, you know, you're still wondering. But
and you feel living here locally, it's not something that's talked about a lot?
No, because it'd be private to that family. So,
yeah.
But I mean, they'd know about it. We've never had murders around here like that, really. It's not a thing that happens in Ireland. Really, as such. I mean, yeah. I suppose there's more of it now than there used to be.
Sophie's family, Brian, they've maintained their links to the area, so perhaps that in itself might make it uncomfortable for people to talk.
I think that's a very good point. Her son, Pierre-Louis, owns and visits Sophie's holiday home near Tourmore. There's huge respect, there's huge admiration, there's huge sympathy for the family locally. So local thoughts and feelings and what they might say publicly on the death of Ian Bailey, who lived here, as I said, it's nuanced somewhat by that fact that Sophie's family still have very active links here. At the end of 2022, for example, behind me here, a tribute night was held in memory of Sophie with music and poetry at the Harbour Hotel. At that time, her uncle Jean-Pierre attended on behalf of the family, and he actually made a point of thanking the local community for all their support over the years. So that link has remained very strong. Just finally, Claire, one man I met this morning a little while ago here in Skull who did know Ian Bailey summed up well, I think, the conflicting emotions and views here locally as news of his death in Bantry reached Skull yesterday.
It's a pity, to be quite honest about it, because if this deed that he's supposed to have done was done, you know, he lived a terrible life. But if it was the other way, then, you know, if he was innocent, it's an awful thing to have someone to have to live with all that torment, like. Nobody can, it was never proved on the man whether he done it or not.
He was convicted in France, but not in Ireland, we know, and he
wasn't
extradited.
Well, like, you were going to expect that anyway. What would you expect? You know, that's all I have to say. The Lord of Mercy
in
his soul.
In terms of the local community here, what has it been like over the last 25 or more years?
Well, I wouldn't comment on it. Yeah. You know, I just keep my opinion of that to myself.
Did you know the man?
Oh, I did, yeah. I often see him. I spoke to him and I couldn't say nothing to the man.
What was he like?
Well, I suppose, like any army person, well, I'd only bid him good day, you know, or something like that, and pass along, and he'd say, well, he'd say just to reply to me.
And generally, what was the reaction to him locally? It must have been difficult at times, I'd imagine.
Oh, I'd say it was.
Yeah.
You know, he drew a lot of attention to himself, you know, that kind of way. That's all I'd have to say about.
I suppose thoughts with Sophie's family today, who still have links in the area here.
Oh, they have, I suppose. Yeah. You know, I feel sorry for them too, to be quite honest. That it was a desperate thing to happen. Somebody did do it. You know, it was an awful tragedy.
Brian O'Connell there. Thank you very much, Brian. And you heard Brian asking that man this question. What was he like? Well, my next guest might have a fair idea of that because RTE's Philip Boucher-Hayes has covered the story extensively over the years and he's here now. Good morning, Philip.
Good morning.
You've interviewed Ian Bailey many times. What was he like?
Met him 12 years ago for the first time when I think, like pretty much everybody else, I was in that kind of camp of, well, there's no smoke without fire. There must be some reason that the guards keep on pursuing this man. And the closer and more detail I looked at this case, the more bizarre and picaresque I realised that it actually was. He was somebody who was very, very hard to hold a clear picture of in your head at the same time because he was so many different contradictions. He was kind, he was generous. He was at times very entertaining company. He was always hail fellow, well met. He was very charismatic individual. He would walk into a room and, you know, his presence was quite magnificent. As he announced himself, you would turn around, you would look at him straight away. But he was also at the same time, at times, a crushing bore, insufferably arrogant, not nearly as intelligent as he thought that he was, and somebody who unfortunately never really properly acknowledged or showed any self-awareness, certainly not when it came to the domestic abuse, the terrible, terrible things that he did to his partner, Jules.
Which he was convicted of course. We heard there, Brian, you know, spoke to some people this morning who wanted to talk about him. A lot of people, when they saw the microphone, said, I'm not going there. Did you always get a sense of that in West Cork, that people were nervous about talking about him?
Again,
or how was he viewed?
The same contradictions again. I walked around Cork city centre with him once. Three people came up to him, almost looked like it was staged that there was so many of them. They came up to him, they shook his hand, they congratulated him for withstanding what they thought was a campaign against him, and they slapped him on the back and said, well done, keep going. But others, you could see that at times there was people in Skull, in Goleen, crossing to the other side of the road to stay away from him. There were people who would say off record the most horrific things about him. Well, that was part of, again, this whole national parlour game that was Ian Bailey, this game that we all played speculating on his guilt or on his innocence. And he became somebody that people loved to hate because as much as they might protest their hate for him, they sought out his company. They wanted to spend time with him. They were frequently entertained when they did. Now, very often it was because they wanted to gather their own little Ian Bailey story to tell their friends about subsequently. But there is no doubt that he was a very social being. He was drawn to being with other people. He needed the attention and the regard of other people. He needed that time in the limelight. And he was, in many respects, I think, the worst person I have ever met, or the person least suited to find themselves becoming a public figure and having this kind of notoriety thrust upon them.
Why do you say that?
Well, a number of different reasons. I think one anecdote that perhaps illustrates this best is I interviewed him at length for a TV documentary that was never aired for legal reasons in the run-up to his case against the state in 2014. And in one very rare moment, he actually asked me a question about my life, because he was never really given to doing that. He asked me how I'd got into journalism. I told him the very unoriginal story about how I had read All the President's Men and seen the movie when I was a 14-year-old boy, and that that had inspired me. A couple of weeks later, he takes the stand in the High Court on the most important platform that he ever secured for defending his name and trying to acquit himself in the court of public opinion anyway. And he was asked again that question, how did you get into journalism? And he offered up my anecdote.
He told your story.
My explanation. I was sitting there in the press box just absolutely perplexed as to why it was that he would do this. And of course, he was pilloried by a senior counsel for the state, who, when they got hold of this, said, Mr. Bailey, you were 14 when you read this book and you saw this movie. Yes, yes, it was. Mr. Bailey, when you were 14, the Watergate break-in hadn't happened. But it was several years off being
written. Did you ever say it to him?
Did I ever pick him up on that? Yeah, I did. I raised an eyebrow with him, and he just, as he so often did, shrugged it off.
Right, and he wouldn't be bothered by that,
no,
you would know.
But I mean, what it did was, I think it shows, number one, certainly he had a very problematic relationship with telling the truth, and telling the truth at the moment that it most counted. But it also showed what a twit he was. And is this somebody that was capable of suppressing evidence of his own guilt for over a quarter of a century? I'd have my doubts.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that in itself is interesting. How is he supporting himself?
Well, when I first met him 12 years ago, he was somebody who had a sense of dynamism and energy about him. He was getting all of his suits from thrift stores, from charity shops. But he was very neatly turned out. He was somebody who was taking quite a lot of pride in his appearance, even if the suits were 15, 20 years out of fashion by that stage. He wore makeup to court in 2014. He was that conscious of his appearance. But after the loss of that case, because most of the evidence was statute barred, it was struck out, it was just too old for the court to consider. After the loss of that case, I think everything started to unravel. He had previously managed to control his relationship with alcohol quite well. He was only drinking very, very occasionally. That turned into drinking an awful lot. And yet he was still constantly drawn to the limelight of this case and drawn back to it. I think one of the more tawdry aspects of the later years of his life is that he was, because he was, huge debts all over the place and limited income, he was selling pizzas in Bantry Market and drawing dole. He was selling selfies in the market. People, usually, unfortunately, young women, would approach him looking for selfies. He would sell them a book of the poetry for hugely overinflated price, €10, mm-hmm. €20 sometimes, and allow people to take a selfie with them. It was undignified. He knew that it was, but that was how he was living, hand to mouth. He was hustling all the time in the latter years.
It was in the later documentaries, it seemed as though he was a very isolated figure towards the end.
He had his friends, he had his loyal supporters, he obviously had his detractors as well, but he kept people at a distance. It's funny, again, it's another one of the contradictions. For a man who showed none of the right sense of decorum and never knew how to conduct himself as a chief suspect in a murder case, in a horrendous murder case, he knew that he had to keep people at a distance as well, and only let very, very few people in.
Mm-hmm. He never said to you that he was considering leaving West Cork, because some people would look at that and go, it was an unusual choice to make to stay there.
Well, let's remember that he was effectively imprisoned because of the French case against him in Ireland. He couldn't leave. There was a European arrest warrant in force if he had gone to any other jurisdiction. So this was, I think he called it a gilded cage. A very pleasant place to have to spend your days, but it was a cage nonetheless, and he was very hurt that he wasn't able to go and see his mum in England as she was dying in the latter years. That he left Skull in the wake of his breakup with Jules Thomas wasn't really surprising to me. And then I think with the loss of all of those support mechanisms, it also wasn't surprising that on the handful of occasions that I met him since then, you could chart the decline. And
you could see it, could you?
Oh, you could see that the relationship with drink had become ever more problematic and that there was a range of other health issues going on there. And I have no doubt that this case, his inability to avoid the limelight, constantly being drawn like the moth to the flame, only exacerbated things, only made it worse, and only probably shortened his life at the end of the day.
We heard Brian there talking about the connection that Sophie Toscan de Plantier's family still have to the area, with the property still there and the regular visits back. This is going to be a very difficult time for them.
The last 27 years have been a very, very difficult time for this family. We constantly lose sight of that in this parlour game that we play about Ian Bailey's guilt or innocence. I think of Bertrand Bougnol, her brother, to whom she was a hero, and he is still somebody who, a very impressive individual, but is quite clearly traumatised by that loss. I think of her son, Pierre-Louis, who never talks to anybody about the day that he found out about his mother's death. He keeps that for himself, but says that that was the day his childhood ended. Mm. He's clearly somebody who's traumatised.
He was 14, was he, when she died?
14 years of age. I think as well of her parents, Georges and Marguerite. Absolutely beautiful woman, serene, really elegant lady. And she still, to this day, every time she sees a young woman with blonde hair in their 20s or 30s, thinks that it could possibly be her daughter. This is a tragedy. It's like an emotional nail bomb going off in the middle of a family, what has happened to them and what they have endured. And I think most tragically, or sorry, perhaps second most tragically, to the fact of her murder. I remember her cousin Alexandra saying to me in near tears on one phone conversation, I hate the fact that she was murdered, but I hate the fact that none of you know her. None of you have any idea who this girl was, what she was like. And to you, she's just a cipher. She is a thing of fun. It's like that. Wasn't it Edgar Allan Poe observed that the murders that are most enduring, the ones that we are most fascinated with, all too often tend to have a dead, beautiful woman at the centre of them. And that is something that never reflects particularly well on all of us in our ongoing fascination with this case.
Philip, thank you very much for coming in. Philip Boucher-Hayes there. We'll be back after this break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.